Air Marshal C.R. Dunlap. It's the 24th of June, 1980.
Okay, sir. You are.
Well, when you rang that bell a moment ago, I was just looking at the morning mail, and in it was a copy of the roster of the World War One Flyers.
Oh, for goodness sake.
And the World War One Flyers have a sort of an association. It's a very informal one. And when I refer to the World War One Flyers, I'm referring to the Canadian
one.
Those who served and trained in Canada and served overseas as Canadians in World War One. And they meet once a year. And, of course, some of them are ex-RFC, and some of them are ex-RNAS, and some of them are RAF. Many of them are RAF because they joined in the last year of the war after the RAF had been formed out of the combination of the Royal Flying Corps and the Royal Naval Air Service. But it's surprising to see that in this year, 1980, which is a long time from the end of the World War I, 1918, mm-hmm. there's still about 350 names listed.
Boy, that's...
Of surviving members.
Yeah.
And the average age of these fellows now has got up to around 83.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Some of them are much older than that. They do have this meeting once a year, and this year they held it in Toronto. There were 100 of them in attendance. The oldest one, I was talking to one of the, when I was in Ottawa last week, I was talking to one of the lads who attended.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of the younger ones. He was only 80. I don't know how he got in. He must have falsified his age to get in.
Yeah.
But he said the oldest one in attendance is Tommy Williams at age 93. And Tommy Williams is still going strong. And he's the one who maintained his flying skills and license longer than any of the rest. He didn't give up flying till he was in his late 80s.
Go ahead.
I think it was 88 or 89 or something like that. And he owned his own machine. He had his own farm down there in the someplace in the Niagara Peninsula or a little further down maybe. And his last flight, he wound up in one of his own apple trees and decided maybe that was time to pack up.
Stop it.
So, but anyway, they're a very enthusiastic and lively bunch, and I've attended a fair number of their meetings. I've spoken to them on the odd occasion. I've taken quite an interest. And it's amazing to see how strong and rugged some of them are. And here they are at this meeting talking about their plans for their 1981 gathering.
Good for them, yeah.
Which I think is going to be out here in the West, maybe in Victoria.
I'm wondering, is there a address of that organization? Could I write and get a list, you suppose?
Certainly. I'll give you the name of the secretary. It's right
okay.
here. It's Ronald E. Norman.
Right.
712-1137 Royal York Road, Islington, Ontario. Postal code M9A.
M9A, right.
4A7.
Okay, see, I was talking to a chap from here. He lives out in Esquimalt. Can't think of his name now. But he said to phone him after this, after that he was back, around the end of June sometime, after he's back from the thing. So I presume he went to the...
Well, probably.
Well,
now,
thank you very much. Huh?
Last night I was talking to Dr. Roy. I told him that I had just been down to Ottawa, delivering an address to the Convention of Aviation Museum Curators.
Mm-hmm.
And he asked me what I spoke on, and I said, well, I spoke on the interplay between civil and military aviation in the formative years of aviation, and with particular emphasis on the interplay between the nations. The theme of this conference in Ottawa last week was interplay between civil and military aviation in Canada. And when I looked over the speakers, it was a two-day conference, and there were about six or seven speakers altogether. And I looked over the agenda and saw what the others were speaking on. It didn't leave me really anything to touch on in the Canadian scene, and that's the reason I spread it out into the international scene.
Oh, I see.
And went into the early years because the years from 1914-18 onwards were covered by all these speeches in the civil and military field. But I was giving the after-dinner speech, and I chose this rather historic subject. Mm-hmm. And Reg asked me to put this on the tape.
Oh, I see. Is this was something similar to what you said last time we spoke? You talked about Lord Northcliffe and his prize to the flying across.
That was mentioned in this talk.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But this goes a great deal further.
Yeah.
So I'll give you a bit more. But I don't know whether I can reproduce what I had to say precisely, but
close enough, anyway.
Close enough. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I guess we'll start off at Kitty Hawk. Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, December 1917. December 1903. On the 17th of the December, the Wright brothers, Wilbur and Orville, made their first flight from that cold and isolated place on the shores of North Carolina. Now, I think they had chosen this isolated spot for a variety of reasons, because they were anxious to work without too much interference during their test and experimental stage. The result was that when they did take to the air, there were only a handful of people there. The isolation and the cold wintry day was, I guess, responsible for that. Orville made one flight less than 200 feet, but nevertheless, they were airborne under power. And this was the first powered flight in a heavier-than-aircraft, which is a major event in the history of aviation. But they went on, and they did three more flights that day, and, alternating between Wilbur and Orville. And the final flight was about 800 feet. It's probably not a proper term to use, a flight, because it was really, those are just hops. They were hops straight down a field. It was just a matter of getting airborne and doing their utmost to hold it straight and level and get it down again. And, of course, many of the early flights were hops, because they really hadn't progressed far enough to know how to make a turn properly, or nor had the controls of the aircraft advanced sufficiently to make that possible. Because of the limited number of people present and the lack of press, the correspondence, you can say that there really was practically no publicity whatsoever. There was a little, because somebody got wind of it over a telephone. But what publicity was quite distorted. And as a result, the public really didn't become aware of precisely what happened, and they didn't know the significance of what happened. And throughout the United States, people really paid very little attention to it. And I think in many quarters, they tended to look upon these two brothers as crackpots. Well, immediately after opening and the advent of the new year, 1904, they shifted from Kitty Hawk over to Dayton, which is the area in which they lived, Dayton, Ohio. They set themselves up in a farm area about in the pasture of a rather largish farm outside, 8 miles outside Dayton. And they carried on with their experimental flights. And again, they proceeded quietly without much publicity, and they managed to do in that year 105 flights from that field, Huffman's pasture, I guess it was called. That's really quite a lot of flying, and again, those are mainly hops. It wasn't until the end of that year that they managed to do a circuit. They had progressed. Their skills had improved. Their control arrangements for control of the aircraft have improved, and the performance of the engine. It was their own engine. They designed their own engine for this aircraft that had improved, and they did a circuit. Well, that was really quite a major event to get up and do a circuit around land. Now, although the American public didn't know much about what was going on, and the press still didn't come and show any interest whatsoever, these things have happened to getting noised about, and I suppose it's through the embassies and the attachés that Britain had some knowledge of what was taking place. And before the end of 1904, they sent one of their most experienced aeronauts, they called them here, balloonist, a chap who had done ballooning and had done a little bit of powered airship flying, lighter than aircraft, sent him over to negotiate with the Wright brothers, either for the purchase of an aircraft or for manufacturing rights. So Britain, you can see, took a very early interest in this. The Wrights weren't really ready to do business, and nothing came of that. But I think on the strength of it, they felt that perhaps they should check with the U.S. Government and military authorities to see what, if any, interest they had in what was going on. They did this through their congressman, and the message that came back from the congressman was that until such time as they could demonstrate greater capability and reliability, the U.S. government would not be able to do anything to spur them on their way. That left them to finance it on their own, and they weren't wealthy people. They were working people. They had a bicycle shop. And that was one reason things did progress somewhat slowly, is they had to spend time earning their living, and B, they didn't have very much money to spend on equipment and development. But at any rate, there they were, left on their own. Later, when flying started in Europe, most of the people who flew were sportsmen, adventurers, sons of moneyed families, and it was much easier for them to get on with the financing developments, but not so the Wrights. Well, 1905 came, and they made quite a good deal of progress. They carried on their experiments throughout the year, and got to the point where they were able to do a circuit of 25 miles distance, or 25 miles in all around that circuit. Well, now, that was really quite an advance, and their accomplishments, again, were known a bit abroad, because the French, by the end of 1905, had sent information over that they were going to come to enter negotiations. They could see the possibilities. The French are pretty learned on these things, the possibilities that this had for application in the wartime situation. So, when they got word that the French intended arrival, they once again checked with the U.S. authorities, and this time with the U.S. War Department. And the War Department again gave them somewhat the brush off and said that until such time as they could carry a passenger, they could attain a certain reasonable altitude and perform reliably, they couldn't come to their assistance because there'd be no money put in the estimates for this sort of thing. So, in early 1906, two delegations from France came. The first one that came was a military delegation, and the army had a pretty strong delegation to try and get manufacturing rights, and they were interested to determine the performance, and they were anxious to lay down certain requirements that have to be met before they could proceed with any contractual arrangements. And the second delegation that followed that one were a group of industrialists who were interested in the possibilities of manufacture and sale of this flying machine in the European area. The syndicate was known as the Lazare syndicate, and they had pretty good financial credentials and and industrial know-how. And they spent a lot of time with the Wrights over the development of contract and laying down of conditions. And the financial offer to the Wrights was an attractive one. I'm sure it was very tempting to them. Unfortunately, some of the conditions that were prescribed in the contract were a little bit beyond the present capability of the aircraft. For example, they specified that the aircraft not only had to carry a passenger to meet the conditions of the test, but also had to be able to fly 1,000 feet or more. The Wrights and they as Frenchmen generally do, they're very specific when laying down the time factors on this. They weren't going to have this drag out forever. So they laid down that this had to be accomplished by the 1st of August of 1906 before the monies that were put in escrow would be handed over to the Wright brothers. The Wrights rather wisely allowed this proposal to lapse because they realized that they hadn't developed sufficiently far to make this the attainment possible. So the year ended without anything being signed contractually, but for the balance of that year, 1906, they concentrated on increasing the performance of their engine and as well as their aircraft and on its controllability. And by the end of that year, they were ready once again to enter into negotiations with the French. Now, it was inevitable that before long, some adventurous young fellow in one of the major countries was going to emulate the feat of the Wright brothers. And the first venture in one of the other major countries of the Western world took place that very year, 1906. And that was a flight, once again, power flight, control flight in a heavier-than aircraft, was made in France in 1906 by the famous Parisian, I guess you'd call him. He'd been in Paris for so long, the French pretty well claimed him, Santos Dumont. Now, Santos Dumont was a well-known character on the French scene and in the international scene. He was the one who had done so many of the balloon flights in Paris area. He had first of all type to his credit. And he was the first one to fly around the Eiffel Tower when the balloon was reshaped into something resembling an airship and had engines applied, and he was well known for that event. He was well known figure in the sporting adventure world too. So when he made this flight in 1906 in a heavier than aircraft, he didn't fly any further than the Wrights did on the very first day that they flew in Kitty Hawk. But because of his fame and because of good contacts with the press, because it happened near Paris and so on, it was written up in every newspaper in the continent. He got tremendous coverage, and it really had much more impact than the Wright brothers had in the 3 years that they'd been flying up to this time, or almost 3 years. For example, in England, almost every newspaper carried front page feature on this, those that had a front page. And in the Daily Mail, as I mentioned to you last week, they covered it very fully. But Lord Northcliffe, the publisher owner, took his editorial staff to task for not having recognized the true significance of this fight. And he had them produce an editorial the following day And I know I put this on the tape last week, but I'm going to put it on for you again. And this was the gist of the editorial that that appeared. Well, this is actually a quote from it. The time is probably near at hand when this primitive stage of aviation will be followed by an aircraft that will be commercially utilized. The air around London will be darkened by the flight of airplanes. Military frontiers will be virtually annihilated. Aircraft will have the ability to pass freely through the air above the sea. The isolation of the United Kingdom may disappear. Thus, the Santos Dumont success has an international significance. They are not dreamers who hold that air power is even more important than sea power. Now, that was a fairly prophetic utterance to make at that stage of the game. Northrop was doing this to try to stimulate some action on the part of the British. The British were a little bit slow getting off the mark on this. There were a number who had been doing experimental work with gliders and with flight generally, but they hadn't yet got an engine in an airframe and got into the air. And he was anxious to see that rectified and to see the military take some interest and the commercial operator some interest in this new development. Now, meanwhile, as I say, the Wrights continue to develop their aircraft, and by the beginning of 1907, they had a passenger model. Now, when I say a passenger model, it wasn't very different in appearance from the previous one, because both the pilot and the passenger just sat on the leading edge of the wing and not in a cockpit or anything like that. It was a rather exposed type of flight, but it was a... You might say it was a good observation point if you were thinking of using the aircraft for observation purposes. They had improved the performance of the machine to the extent that they did feel capable of opening negotiations again with the French Lazare-Huillet syndicate. And to that end, Wilbur went across to France and again got into huddle with the syndicate and their lawyers. Now, he wasn't a businessman at all, and he wasn't legally inclined, and these lawyers got him fairly riled and upset almost every time he got into huddle with that type of animal. And things didn't go too well, because they kept introducing new conditions. And I would judge that he got a little bit annoyed with the way things were developing. And again, that that year passed without the demonstration to the French and to the syndicate taking place. However, in anticipation of conducting the demonstration, they had shipped their aircraft to France, crated it and shipped it. And here it was, sitting on the docks at Le Havre, while all these negotiations were taking place. And finally, Wilbur walked out and left them cooling their heels and did nothing further on negotiations that year. The aircraft sat on the docks at Le Havre, and it was there for many months, upwards of a year, well, almost a year, before anything further developed. Meanwhile, Wilbur did go and visit the UK and visit Germany, paving the way in those countries for future negotiations. When 1908 rolled around, Wilbur once again went back to France, and they did work out an acceptable agreement, he and his legal types on the French side of the team. And before midsummer came, they had the crated aircraft moved over to the racetrack at Le Mans and assembled. A good deal of corrosion and had taken place, and a good deal of damage had taken place in handling the aircraft. So Wilbur was very deliberate in getting that thing set up just to his liking. So sort of a month or two went by without anything happening other than the rehabilitation of the aircraft. But finally, he indicated he was ready. And the principals of the company were there on this great date. Military and civil authorities were very much in evidence. And, of course, the Aero Club of France was represented in order to make this flight an official flight. When finally said he was he would take the air, he indicated that he wasn't going to in any way try to meet the conditions of the contract on this first flight. This was more of a test flight. And to him, it was a fairly simple routine event. He took off. He did two circuits of the field. And then he followed these two circuits by a figure of eight. And the crowds on the ground were absolutely ecstatic. Nothing like this had ever happened in France. These flights, the flight by Santos Dumont, for example, although it got great publicity, it was just a hop. It wasn't a circuit or anything like that. Here there was a man up there doing two circuits in the field, doing a figure of eight, coming down, making a good landing. He was a hero overnight. It was a fantastic event in the eyes of the Europeans. And from that day onwards, every few days or every week, some new spectacular would be put on. And his his efforts were to keep stretching the duration of each flight till he got close to the specification laid down in the contract, which was one of the conditions, which was to fly more than 50 kilometers. each time he made one of these flights, improving on the last one, there would be more and more crowds coming in and from European countries. Dignitaries, attaches, and royalty. Everybody was interested. And came the day that he felt equal to meeting all the conditions of the contract. He had two pylons placed. By this time, they moved from Le Mans 2 miles out to a more convenient field, not very far from there. They had two pylons laid out, and he undertook to... Of course, when you fly, these pylons were a kilometer apart. When you fly around two pylons like that, you're doing more or less a circle. So your distance is much greater than just twice the distance of that 1 kilometer separation. So he did, in this critical day, he did 24 circuits of the pylon, much to the elation of everybody, and he met the terms of the contract, was awarded the, which was very important to the rights of this stage, the financial considerations, and was besieged by many people from other countries to seek concurrence in entering into agreements for manufacture and so on. Also, he entered into, this was actually part of the agreement with the French syndicate, entered into an agreement to provide instruction on the aircraft, teach pilots to fly, and also teach mechanics to maintain and so on. So he, as a result of these conditions, he had to set up a flying school in France. He set it up at down at Pau, and there trained not only Frenchmen but people from other nations. Italians were trained there too, and in due course went down and did some training in Italy itself. But it really was, there was a very sudden surge in the development at this particular point. And this was in 1908. Now, Orville was still back in the States. And by this time, the success of Wilbur in France that had become well known, not only in Europe, but back in the U.S. And the U.S., the people in the U.S., the authorities in the U.S. were getting interested. And they laid down some conditions, which were by nature of a sort of a rough specification. And this contained a financial consideration. If they were able to meet these conditions, it would be very much the benefit of the Wright brothers. So, Orville put on the first demonstration for the U.S. War Department in 1908. Now, he wasn't again attempting to meet all the conditions, but it was a demonstration leading up to a later flight, which would hopefully release the prize money. And in this fight, he did successfully. Orville carried a succession, two or three different officers of the U.S. Army on successive flights, and successfully flew at a reasonable altitude, which was gave promise of greater things to come. Now, another event of the same year that I think I should mention to bring in activity in other countries, and this actually started, had its roots in 1907, but it didn't come in really fruition until the year 1908, and that was the formation in Canada, at Medec, Nova Scotia, of an organization formed under the auspices of Alexander Graham Bell and financed to some extent by Mrs. Bell, formation of an organization known as the Aerial Experimental Association, the AEA. Up to this date, Alexander Graham Bell, who summered each year at Bedeck, had done a great deal of experiments in aerodynamics. He had built gliders, he had built kites, he had done experimental work in all sorts of shapes and forms. And this had started before the turn of the century. He and Langley in the U.S. had collaborated a good deal, and Bell and Turnbull, who was operated just outside St. John, New Brunswick, and who was had delved deeply into the science of aerodynamics. Hadn't done any flying or anything like that, but he'd made a study of it. He was a very able mathematician, made a study of aerodynamics, and he and Bell collaborated. So there was a good background there of the experimental development. And Mrs. Bell, sitting there hearing these people talk about the aviation progress so far, on an occasion in 1907 when Jack McCurdy and Casey Baldwin had just come down from the University of Toronto. McCurdy was a Bedeck boy. McCurdy's father worked for Graham Bell up there as secretary to him when he was holidaying in Bedeck. And both of them were engineers, and both of them were keenly interested in all these aviation developments. And Bell saw in them the possibility of organizing something and getting into the air themselves. So they formed this syndicate association, and it was composed of Bell, Jack McCurdy, the Bedeck boy, Casey Baldwin, the Toronto lad. Bell felt it was essential that they bring in an engine, a manufacturer of light engines, so they invited Glenn Curtis from Hammondsport, New York, to join the association because he was a manufacturer of motorcycles, and as such he built a fairly lightweight motorcycle engine. He was a natural to bring into the syndicate, and Bell rather wisely asked the U.S. Army if they would like to designate a liaison officer and have him a member of the team, and that was the way by which Lieutenant Thomas Selfridge came into this association. There were the five of them. They worked in the summer of 1907 in Bedeck. They did a few... They at Bedeck that summer, they confined their activities to the man carrying kites. And then at the end of the summer season, they moved off to Hammondsport, New York, where Ben Curtis had his factory. And they carried on through that winter at that location, designing their first aircraft and building. And the active members of that team, of course, Bell was busy with his other activities. So he was leaving at the Hammondsport site, he was leaving the development, the construction work to this team. And the four of them, they started off and they built four aircraft there initially. One was called the Red Wing, one the White Wing, one the June Bug, and the other the Silver Dart. And each one of those aircraft was attributed to one of the members of the team. One designed the Red Wing, another the White Wing, and it was generally, and the Junebug was credited generally to Glenn Curtis. I think they probably all had a hand in it, but Glenn Curtis, it was his design. Junebug, it was quite a successful aircraft. And then came the Silver Dart, and that was the one that was credited to Jack McCurdy, and he did most of the flying on that. By the end of 1908, they had done a number of successful flights. They'd flown all of these, but the ones that permitted the greatest amount of flying were the Junebug and the Silver Dart. At the end of 1908, in December 1908, McCurdy flew the Silver Dart on 9 or 10 occasions off the ice adjacent to the factory, near the factory in Hammondsport, New York. And it was at that stage that Alexander Graham Bell, who was so devoted to his early experimental work in Bedeck, felt that it would be fitting and appropriate and desirable for the Silver Dart to be sent up to Bedeck and flown from the ice in Bedeck Bay. And that did take place, and in February of the following year, 1909, the aircraft was assembled. And on the 23rd of February, McCurdy made what was probably one of the coldest flights that had been made so far. He got onto that open leading edge of that wing with practically no protection and took off, and he flew a fairly lengthy hop down the lake and landed it. That was a historic flight. It was the first flight by a member of the British Empire made within the British Empire. Now, McCurdy and Baldwin had both flown in Hammondsport, New York, the previous year, but I'm saying this was the first flight by a member of the British Empire within the British Empire. And that included Britain still hadn't made such a flight. So it was a very historic event for Canada. Now, Baldwin and Casey Baldwin and Jack McCurdy went on with their work at Bedeck. They stayed there. They made a number of flights in the succeeding weeks and some fairly lengthy circuits around there. And they decided it was high time they built another a couple of aircraft modeled on the Silver Dart, so they proceeded to construct the Bedeck 1 and the Bedeck 2. So there they had, they now had three aircraft. The association had really accomplished what it set out to do, the AEA, and that was to demonstrate their capability to successfully fly powered heavier than aircraft. And it was decided that they would disband the association and that Ben Curtis would go his own way in Hammondsport and Baldwin and McCurdy would go their own way in Canada. And they formed their own little Canadian association, and having done so, they felt it was time that they got in touch with Ottawa and arranged for a demonstration to be made there. And did I put this on the tape last week too? Their flight at Petawawa? So they went, Bell actually went up to Ottawa. He had many good connections there. Now, he spoke, I think it was at the Canadian Club, and described the progress that had been made, and through this sought cooperation of the military and political government authorities, and went to see the right people after that, and managed to get things set up for a demonstration at Petawawa that coming summer. So in August of 1909, the military and civil authorities assembled at Petawawa to witness the demonstration of the capabilities of these young men, of these primitive aircraft. The Silver Dart was the first one to fly. Well, now, Petawawa wasn't a good location for them to choose for tests like this because it's a very sandy area, as you know, and the area that was available to them, the sand was a bit loose. Now, the undercarriage of that machine, the Silver Dart, and the same applied to the Bedeck 1 and the Bedeck 2, consisted of motorcycle wheels. Those had come from Ben Curtis' factory. And the motorcycles of that day had very rather small and narrow tires. So that unless they had something firm to sit on, they tended to dig in. And in that sand, with the weight of the aircraft and with an extra passenger on board, they had great difficulty moving in the soft sand. Indeed, they had to have half a dozen people push the aircraft to get it started before they could really... This didn't make for a very good, impressive demonstration to a group of officials to have about anything from 6 to 10 people push the aircraft to get it started. But the real trouble came in the landings, because if they happened to land where the sand was really soft, the thing dug in, and each landing was a hazardous operation. So they made 4 successful flights that first day. Too bad they didn't leave it at that. But the fifth one was late in the afternoon. They were landing into the sun. Couldn't see too clearly what the surface sand conditions were. And they dug into a very soft place, and the aircraft was quite severely damaged. Undercarriage torn off, the wing torn off. The officials were not impressed. They decided that they would repeat the test on one of the Bedeck designs, and Silver Dart having been put out of action. And they therefore assembled one of the, I think it was the Bedeck 2 that they assembled, not the Bedeck 1, and got it ready for flight. They were ready for a further test a week later. And they got many of the same people out for the demonstration. But once again, the experience was very similar. They made 4 successful flights, and on the fifth flight, they severely damaged the aircraft, and the officials dispersed without showing any real interest in development. And it was a mite early for them to enter into any commitments. Things were still in a kind of primitive stage, but I'm sure their view was affected considerably by what had happened. So, aviation in Canada went to rest for a while. This was 1909, and it remained dormant for a fair number of years to come. I'll come back to that later. Now, back in France, I just dropped back to 1908 again. Towards the end of 1908, and continued on into 1909, there was another rather notable break into aviation by a young member of a sporting and adventurous family, and that was the occasion of Henri Farman getting into aviation. He was able... There was enough development taking place in France at that stage that he, who had the financial means to do this, was able to purchase an aircraft. He purchased a Voisin, one of the first Voisins to be constructed, set out to learn to fly, and in the
in early 1909, he was able to fly well enough to enter. And this is a strange thing. There were prizes being offered in France at this stage, 1908-1909, which could have been won by the Wright brothers way back in 1904. But the feats of the Wright brothers were so little known in those periods, intervening periods, that here were wealthy Frenchmen offering prizes for people to fly, what had already been done many times over in the United States. But there was this prize, and it was a very simple, elementary condition, offered by a chap by the name of Archdeacon, I suppose it was, given the French pronunciation, I don't know how you pronounce Archdeacon in French, Archdeacon. All that a fireman had to do was to make one straight and level flight for just a very few kilometers, I've forgotten exactly how many. And this he did. In the early part of 1909, he qualified for the prize money with a fairly substantial prize, and it set him up in the aviation business. There were three Farman brothers. Now, this is interesting. They were, although these young lads in France grew up in Paris, they were known in France as Henri Farman and Maurice Farman, and there was a third one, Richard Farman. They were known in England by the British equivalents because their father was actually the press correspondent in Paris for the Manchester Guardian, or the Daily Telegraph, I've forgotten which one it was, one of those two major newspapers. They were Britishers, but the boys, of course, father had been in Paris on this assignment for quite a long time, and their boys were educated in France, so they had taken on the French pronunciation for the name, but they were still British subjects. Now, they were a bright family and very competent and adventurous, and Henri Farman and Maurice decided that it would be a good thing to get into the manufacturing business, so they designed their own aircraft. They set up a factory with the money that Henri had earned in the competition, and they established this small factory at Billancourt, just south of Paris. It's a famous old military airfield in that area. And their design was a reasonably good one for that time frame. And they got some orders from the French authorities, and in a very short time, Britain approached them with a view to setting up a British factory, and they started to manufacture aircraft over at Bradford in Britain. So there was a move forward on the part of Britain to get into this aviation game. Still, there had not been a flight in Britain by a Briton. So that flight by Farman had some great interest around Europe, and Lord Northcliffe once again, on behalf of the Daily Mail, got into the act, and still being a bit concerned by the fact that Britain was doing rather limited amount of activity in this field, he offered a prize for the first aircraft to fly from London to Manchester. Now, I think this is what we put on the table last week, wasn't it, the reference to that?
Yeah.
He was ridiculed by the press, by Punch magazine, and in public by people he met, being accused of entering into trying to get cheap publicity by making such an offer. He offered $50,000 for £10,000 actually, which in those days was $50,000, for the first person to fly London to Manchester. He did that, to stimulate interest in aviation. But the reaction was that he was
he was being so far-fetched that it was just equivalent to offering a prize to fly to the moon and back. And it was so much beyond a reasonable accomplishment that they gave him a really rough time. And I think I put Limerick on here last week, didn't I?